Welcome to the IC Interviews. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today is Carlos Hardenberg, co-manager of Mobius Investment Trust. Carlos is perhaps best known as manager of Templeton Emerging Markets Investment Trust between 2015 and 2018, during which time this fund delivered outstanding performance, though his investment career goes back far longer. Carlos' current fund, Mobius Investment Trust, invests in emerging markets smaller companies selected via criteria including environmental, social and governance factors.
So just by way of background, we have invested, as you know, Mark Mobius and myself, in emerging markets for a long time, for many decades. We went through all the different cycles and developments from the earlier developments in emerging markets, which was mainly infrastructure developments and then the first wave of consumption, and then more and more innovation took place. And so we've been through all of these phases. And one of the observations that we made was that these companies very often are run by phenomenal entrepreneurs. They really know how to run the business, and they are very good operators. But one of the areas that they in many cases neglect relate to governance, transparency, and other aspects which are important for other shareholders. And we have started to work on governance improvements maybe 15, 17 years ago in Brazil, in Korea, in other markets of this world, in Turkey. And we started to always review, for example, the composition of boards and the quality of boards, as this is always the first starting point. If you have a proper supervisory board, which is independent, which has very clear KPIs, follows clear policies, that's always insurance policy. And therefore, you know, we have overall, Mark and myself, we appointed over 80 board members in emerging markets over the last many years. And we've seen that by doing that, it created a better relationship between us and other shareholders and portfolio companies. It created this most valuable currency of confidence and trust in these businesses. And most importantly, it led to a relative outperformance of these companies. When companies start to play by the rules, become more transparent, have better policies and governance rules in place, they typically start to outperform as well. And there are many ways how you can explain this. That allows them to, you know, it also means that, for example, they have the better employee share incentivization programs in place. It means that they invest in internal aspects that lead to better culture, et cetera. And it leads to lower staff turnover. It leads to these companies incurring less, for example, regulatory fines. And as these companies then really become leaders, also in reputation, it also allows them to attract better people overall. So there are many ways how you can explain why these companies are outperforming. And then ESG came into the conversations a couple of years ago. It was a new terminology for something that we had actually worked on long before. You know, ESG is, I think, only telling part of the whole story. It goes much wider than this box-ticking activity, which is sometimes seen as today. But now there is a race towards improving ESG criteria or ESG ratings, as again, over the past 10 years, or actually 15 years, companies which have received a higher and improving ESG rating also outperformed the local markets and global emerging markets. So this is why we think focusing on smaller companies which are not rated yet, which have the opportunity to receive a rating and improve their rating, are the ones which are likely to outperform going forward as well.
Okay, now you say that you work with companies to improve their ESG, but also their culture, which is something other fund managers don't mention. I mean, what do you mean by culture? Why is it important, and how do you help companies improve their culture?
You know, the most important part of this is that, first of all, whenever you analyze the most successful business models in emerging markets, in most in 9 out of 10 cases, as you dig deeper into the team, into the story, into the into these corporates, you will find that they all have one commonality, and that is that people love to work for them. They feel very engaged. They feel that the company is doing a lot for them as well, and they feel part of a family. And then in contrast, other companies in emerging markets, when you speak to the CEOs and you ask them the question you just raised, how would you describe your culture? They will say, we don't know. Well, what do you mean by that question? So it is, it's been our job for a long time to identify those factors, which are sometimes kind of in the they're sort of gray zones. How do you define culture? What differentiates a company with a strong corporate culture from one with a weak corporate culture? And at the end of the day, there are multiple factors, but they always start with how companies deal not just with the individual employees, but also with their families. What do they offer? What kind of activities do they do so that employees really associate with the success of the business? And of course, one of the, there are some technical aspects that how you can manage culture. And one is to not only provide an incentive system, which is linked to not just performance, but also to other factors, not just to senior management, but to all employees. So, for example, one of the activities we are seeing lately is that companies are increasingly linking performance, not just to financial targets, but also to, for example, social, environmental, and governance-related targets. And if they are met over a certain period, employees can directly enjoy the benefit of those achievements. And it's about inclusion, it's about diversity, it's about creating the right opportunities to also progress in a business, it's about career planning, and it's about the offering which kind of also falls outside of the business. Do they allow employees to work in a flexible fashion? Do they have programs to support families and mothers with children? This may be seen as a normal thing in the UK, but certainly not in most Asian countries, Latin America or Africa. That's why we started this website, ESG Plus C. Actually, you can check out the website. We just started this program where we start to monitor, track, and report on these cultural aspects which describe businesses in our field. So it's pretty wide-ranging and wide-reaching. It's pretty complex, and it's not black and white. And there's a very interesting which I can share with you, which is the it's called it was actually a study done in the US, and they ranked companies which had a higher rating in terms of their cultural perception in the wider space in the market, and they measured the performance of the so-called culture portfolio in the US over 10 years, and it outperformed significantly. So increasingly also, this is something which investors are trying to get a handle on, like how to measure this. You know, shall we only look at margin improvements and financial results, or shall we also look at other factors?
Because corporate governance standards are lower in emerging and frontier markets, is it harder to work with companies to, you know, achieve this? And to what extent can you trust them to do what they say?
It really depends where and in which country, and you have to pick companies very carefully. I mean, to give you an example, and I think one of your questions also related to China. Of course, the situation in China in general is much more difficult than it is in other markets. In China, you have many different stock exchanges. You have all sorts of different classes of shares. You know, you have A shares, Hong Kong listed, Chinese names, Chinese companies listed in the U.S., on Canada. So it's then you have local stock exchanges where foreigners can't even invest into. So it's a pretty and then, you know, the reporting standards, the transparency in China is still in general extremely poor. So I would say engaging with companies in China is the most challenging activity globally compared to all the other emerging market engagement attempts that we're doing. But there's a lot happening. So to give you an example, we have started to demand from our portfolio companies to adopt the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure recommendations. And we also asked from every portfolio company to integrate ESG targets into executive compensation. So these are, you know, two pretty significant demands that we had. And we started asking for these things a number of years ago. And we are seeing that they are the first companies, the first group of companies, which are doing exactly this. So the first, you see more and more announcements of a relatively small group of Chinese companies, but they're well known companies and they're important players in the market that start to do that. They integrate ESG targets into executive compensation.
Actually, what will be examples of portfolio holdings that have done this?
For example, Yum. Yum China. They have done both. And they are also, they were just recognized as a top employer in China, as well as being, they were named in the Bloomberg Gender Equality Index for the first time. Similarly, even in places like Vietnam, you're seeing this, where companies are rapidly moving up that learning curve and they're trying to address those issues. Also, there has been a recent activity by the stock exchange actually in Hong Kong, which is increasingly, they just put together like a task force, like a working group to define exactly the new requirements, ESG requirements for listed companies, also, of course, Chinese listed companies in Hong Kong. And they're getting kind of tougher and tougher on the requirements, on the reporting requirements, on the ESG transparency related requirements, etc. So I would say relatively early days in places like China, but the journey has started.
Is it a better situation in some other countries?
Oh, yes. I mean, I tell, for example, in countries like, to give you one example, I started doing this work in Turkey many years ago, where we looked at ESG factors and tried to implement those in companies and tried to ask for more transparency, etc. And now I actually no longer have to do this because you have local investors which are becoming even more aggressive about this. So there's an initiative by the local stock exchange that require implementation of ESG-related disclosure practices in Turkey. In places like in Latin America, the stock exchanges are offering a rebate on the listing fees if companies obtain a higher rating. In Latin America, we recently had a number of companies that were added to the Dow Jones Sustainability Index.
So, is this a particular Latin American country,
Brazil. I mean, you know, we read so much negative press about Brazil right now with the Amazon and Bolsonaro, but there are different realities. You know, companies in the private sector are increasingly sensitive to environmental issues, for example, and also to governance-related issues and social-related issues, so gender equality, equal pay, inclusion factors play an increasing role in the private sector in Brazil. I find it highly irritating how the country is often portrayed right now by the press.
Hmm. Now, there's increasing opportunities, but does including ESG and culture considerations in your investment criteria mean you have to forgo investments that you would have invested in otherwise?
So, you know, in doing this in emerging markets requires a very different recipe than in developed markets like the UK or US. You cannot apply a standardized one-fits-all policy to these emerging market companies. First of all, if you really want to make a difference, then you have to come to the table and allow these companies time to develop skills, to develop know-how in order to deal with these often quite difficult requirements. It's not easy to implement this overnight. So we don't follow like a box. We don't follow like this inclusion or exclusion policy. We do not exclude companies which have a relatively poor rating today. We are trying to look for companies which have the right people, the right mindset, the right business model, and which may have shortcomings on the ESG side, but which have indicated the willingness to work with us to improve. That's the key. We've had a number of very, very positive surprises. Only in the, you know, the fund is now almost 3 years old, our new fund at Mobile Capital. But even in those 3 years, we've had a lot of very positive developments in portfolio companies that really move up this learning curve very steeply. And they looked like, you know, almost lost cases on governance some years ago, because the founders felt that, for example, the board should be made up of all of their friends and family, which is not necessarily, it's not that unusual. It was the same in the UK and in Germany some, you know, decades ago. Mm-hmm. But learned that, you know, we learned why this is not the right way, and so are they now.
Another aspect of your investments approach is that you take a private equity approach to investing in public markets. Why is this better than taking a conventional approach, and how, you know, how do you do it? How do you go about taking a private equity approach to public equities?
Well, that's a, it's a big word in a way, and I'd say that what we mean by this is that we try to, we run a very concentrated portfolio. This is a key difference between us. If you look at the typical trusts in the UK, they have 120 holdings. They're very close to the index. We have close to nothing compared to the index. Our active share is the highest in the industry.
When you say index, do you mean MSCI emerging markets?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So we have close to no overlap. Few points. Most of the other funds, if you look at the 20 largest holdings, it's exactly Samsung, Baidu, Tencent, etc., Naspers. We really have put together, I would say, the most differentiated and unique portfolio to get exposure to this mid-cap segment, which is highly vibrant, which is very, very exciting, which is disrupting in nature, which is run by founders and families. And when you invest in these companies, often you, of course, meet standards, governance standards, transparency standards, reporting standards, which are just not world-class. They are world-class in what they do, but they are not world-class in playing by those rules which are required in the capital markets. And this is where we then, and that's now coming to your question on private equity approach, this is where we then develop a very intense relationship with the families and founders and senior management, where we are offering advice on how to optimize their profile. And typically, we will provide an extensive presentation to the senior management where we summarize our findings, our observations, and where we are offering them solutions, how they can improve their general governance-related policies and standards, etc. And we've made so many, you know, we have the experience that we made in the markets over the last decades, and we're just offering it to them. And that's much more like what private equity investors are doing. We also look at, we're really trying to see ourselves as long-term investors. We're not flipping stocks around, and we are seeing that this engagement part, which is accompanying our stock selection, can really create a lot of value for these businesses going forward. So that's why we call it a private equity approach.
Yeah. I mean, just jumping to another question, you mentioned the fact that you do have a relatively small number of holdings, 29 according to your March fact sheet, and 10 of these, the 10 largest, account for over 60% of trust assets. Doesn't this create excessive risk? Because, I mean, these holdings, they're not, say, like large liquid companies. They're small companies, and they're in frontier and emerging markets. I mean, that sounds like, you know, a concentrated portfolio of really, really risky holdings.
I don't think so at all, because the risk at the end of the day, this is often the misunderstanding. First of all, you can really diversify currency risks, single company risks, sector risks, geographic risks with around 25 to 30 stocks. You can do that technically. And there are sufficient statistical studies out there which prove that point. But more importantly, I think it's how you define risk. We define risk through the lens of the companies that we invest in. So to give you an example, we have close to 30% invested in India. You may think, oh my God, you know, India recently has been not performing really. Yeah. It's going through a difficult period. Our Indian portfolio has outperformed significantly. And many of our Indian stocks are up more than 30% year to date alone. They performed really well last year and they continue to perform really well this year. And why is that? Because we have invested very conservatively in businesses which, number one, have very little debt. We don't like businesses which are flush with debt that they have to deal with at times. And if you simply look at the index, the large companies in there, which you may think are less risky, they have very they have much more vulnerable balance sheets. Number two, we have not invested in large financial institutions or large companies in general, which are increasingly seeing pressure from the regulators, from the tax collection agencies, etc. No, we invested in smaller businesses which are vibrant, which are innovative. We also invested in companies which have a diversified geographical exposure. So Persistent Systems, as an example, is generating revenues globally. In the US, in Europe, and many other places. And then our focus on healthcare as well. We think that the next super cycle in emerging markets is not just education, but also healthcare services and products. And we invested in one of the leading healthcare diagnostic center operator in India. So here's a good example. Is it risky to have few investments, very carefully selected investments in India? No, it's been less risky. Similarly, in Turkey, is like the ugly chicken in emerging markets right now. They have a currency issue, they have a political issue, they have all sorts of risks. We invested in the software business in Turkey, which is not in the index. It's not owned by anyone else I know of our.
What's the name of a company? Sorry.
It's called Logo.
Yeah.
And Logo has done really well. Logo is doing extremely well. Why? Again, they have close to no debt. They are a local leader in technology. They are run by the founder. Very innovative business. They have against competition because of the difficulties in Turkey. Because foreign companies haven't been very aggressive. So last year and again this year, they continue to do really well. So this is how we manage risk, whether it's in Turkey, whether it's in China, whether it's in Brazil. You have to define what you mean by risk in your stock selection.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you like companies that are resilient, that don't have much debt, and you like innovative business models. A bit more about, what you look for in terms of a company that's resilient and has an innovative business model, and perhaps a few examples.
Yes. Let me give you one example. And let's turn to Taiwan, because to me, I think sometimes I have this idea to recall the trust, Asian Opportunity Trust or something, because the more work you do, the more time in emerging markets, the more you realize the biggest opportunities are in Asia. And in Asia, I wouldn't necessarily just say China. China is, of course, filled with opportunities, but also Taiwan and Korea. And I'm not talking about Samsung, and I'm not talking about TSMC, which everybody knows and owns. I'm talking about the mid-cap segment, companies which are highly innovative, that are registering patents every week, that are attracting phenomenal engineers and scientists. And one example is eMemory. eMemory technology is a business that caught our eye because they, year after year after year, it's a small, when we started investing, it was just a few hundred million market cap. The year after year, they've been winning awards from TSMC. You're aware of TSMC, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the largest foundry. They won year after year awards from TSMC as one of their preferred suppliers of so-called IC design. And what eMemory focuses on, this is a bunch of highly talented engineers and scientists that constantly come up with new design ideas that one part of this design solutions and software programs that they offer ensure that chips produced by TSMC have a unique fingerprint, they call it, and are no longer vulnerable to external intrusion. So they're safe against external hackers, and they have this special encryption technology which saves you from being exposed to external intrusion. For example, your laptops, your smartphone, handheld devices, data centers, you name it. And they've been really successful in developing this. It's a small company. You would think that only big companies can do this. It's a small company that is a global leader in this technology. They're also a global leader in a technology called embedded non-volatile memory. Embedded non-volatile memory. And that is securing performance, again, of logic chips when power supply isn't stable, which is a big big subject for especially things like Internet of Things, and as the semiconductor content is spreading out globally into automobiles, etc. This is very important to ensure there's high performance. So we started to dig up this, or learn more about the company. We had multiple calls with them. They didn't have very good communication. They didn't have very good investor relations materials. This was one of the areas which we engaged in with them, and they quickly moved up the learning curve and really have produced now world-class materials, better transparency. We also introduced them to sell-side analysts so they can start covering them. So this is one example. I mean, I can give you many examples. There's a company called Parade, which is, again, an IC design. They are focusing on the signal improvement between the GPU and the screens, which is increasingly a difficult subject because the data is getting in more intense and more intense as we speak, and the screens are getting more sophisticated, and they have to deal with a lot more volume and data and complexity. And again, they're a global leader in providing solutions.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're finding a lot of opportunities in Asia. I mean, do you consider the geography of a company at all when you're seeking stocks, or do you purely seek them, from a bottom-up basis on the basis of a company's merits?
Whether geography plays a role for us, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, we always prefer to invest in companies that are based in countries typically which provide the right environment for them to flourish. So we stayed away from Argentina. We have not invested in many African countries simply because we think it's easy to get carried away, but at the end of the day, very tough operating environments. And therefore, geography plays a role for us. Macroeconomic factors play a role. The openness of countries play a role. The regulatory environment plays a role, etc. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Big exception where we have just simply weighed the kind of the risks against the opportunities of the individual company, and it's one it's been helping us a great deal, was the right decision. Sometimes companies can do really well even if the macro environment is tough, but in general we prefer like countries in Asia where you have very strong macro conditions as well.
Okay. I mean, out of interest, I mean, you've described in quite a lot of detail your investment approach. How's it different to the investment approach you took when you were working at Franklin Templeton, which is obviously, you know, a large global asset manager? You guys are a small boutique. You know, what's different?
We are far more specialized now. Do not run zillions of portfolios for zillions. We don't try to offer everything to everyone. We have one strategy, which makes a big difference. It may sound like, I think this needs to be stressed a big way, because there's just this one focus on one strategy, and this, we want this to work. So that's number one. Number two, we work a lot more with external experts. I don't believe that you can always have the best people internally. It's a nice marketing story, but it doesn't exist. If you be really good in understanding a special subsector in China or Brazil or Turkey or South Africa, there are local universities, there are think tanks, there are local scientists and engineers you want to work with. You don't want the, you know, internal guy who knows everything. So that's a second difference. And also the degree of concentration. Most of the large funds, and that was an increasing irritation for us, become more and more like the index themselves. And these companies even don't allow you to move away from the index. Mm. And we said, stop this. We want to invest in companies. We are not interested if a company is in the index or not. We want to focus on this most vibrant mid-cap segment only. And we think we, you know, that's how Mark started and I started back in, when I joined Mark in 99, discussed the index. We had a very high active share and a pretty concentrated fund. And we delivered really good results. And that's what we really wanted to come back to.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that, your Indian holdings have actually held up really well last year and this year, despite the situation. Obviously, the situation's got a lot worse in the past month. What are the prospects for these holdings going forward? And, you know, would you reconsider any of it in view of, you know, I suppose, unprecedented and serious situation that's, you know, happening now in India?
No, we have invested in, so we have Apollo Tubes, Systems, Metropolis Healthcare, so we all of these companies we've invested because we think they will do very well over the next decade. Stop. And they are blessed with fantastic management teams. They are the best in what they do. They have very strong moats around their business. They are superior in terms of profitability. They may run into more trouble this year. This may get much worse. I don't think so, but it may get much worse. Who am I to know this? But these businesses will come out as leaders, and they will win relatively because they will utilize this period of weakness to solidify their own business model. They can do this because they have plenty of cash available, which others don't. So they can either even acquire competitors which run into bigger trouble, and they can endure these times by also having a fairly diversified business model. So very clearly, no, I'm very happy about our positioning.
Yeah. What do you say are, you know, the big risks to, you know, the areas you invest in at the moment?
I think the biggest risk is always that there is some unforeseen governance-related problem, like a Wirecard moment. That is something which we can, which we're trying to control as much as possible by trying to choose trustworthy people. But you never know; there can always be something wrong, and they can always, you know, there can always be. But we're trying to really scrutinize on the numbers, etc. But there's never a guarantee. I mean, I experienced this often enough. Apart from this. I think, obviously, you know, there is a increasing tension in Asia between China and its neighbors, which we are watching very carefully. There's an increasing tension there. And I think the situation in Hong Kong is not a good one. The situation between China and Taiwan needs to be watched. It was the same a few years ago, but it is certainly intensifying. The language is intensifying. The threat is not getting smaller. So that's another one. I do not think there's going to be some totally unforeseen, sudden, gigantic move by the Chinese. That's not their handwriting. They will do this very slowly and gradually over decades. Hmm. It's a risk. And then I also have to say, I mean, obviously, the risk of a new mutant, as we discussed at the beginning, call, but that's not specific to emerging markets. Lastly, I think in Africa, I mean, the disappointment, I'm optimistic about Africa long term, but I think that they are missing still a lot of opportunities by still having too much discipline, too little discipline with regards to creating more reliable institutions. And we have invested in Kenya, in Safaricom, which is doing really well, but there should be more of these opportunities. And one great example is Nigeria. It should be a very wealthy country, but it's not happening. And there's just too much or too little investment into the right into the right areas in the economy, and there's still the lack of political stability there, which is pestering the country.
Okay. On the note of risk, you don't currently have any gearing that is debt. Why is that? Is it because you're concerned about risk, or is that just general policy?
No, we can do that. I mean, the last year was not an easy year to negotiate this and to structure. Our focus has been number one to ensure that we deliver outstanding returns and that our investors can kind of see this proof of concept that it works, that it's differentiated, that we can beat the competition, that we're offering a unique angle to this part of emerging markets. And we needed to focus on the three-year mark, which we are getting to now. We're celebrating our third year. We had a phenomenal year last year. We had a very good first quarter. I think we have a good chance to end this year well. Then to kind of consolidate the trust, to raise more money, to make the trust more meaningful. Look, we are subscale. We're too small. We have issued shares in the past. We are seeing a good momentum right now. There's an increasing number of buy recommendations, investors that are knocking on the door to come in. And once we can bring this to a higher flying altitude, we would also consider leverage.
Okay. What contributed to the strong performance relative to the indices over the past year?
Well, last year and also into this year, it's really stock selection. And it's been India. India has been one of the driving forces behind performance. We invested in companies which were really under-owned, not discovered well, not understood well. And it turned out to be really good to focus on that smaller segment. they are now being increasingly recognized and their strength are becoming very visible. But also Taiwan with eMemory, which has done really well. But even our stock selection China with Yum, which just reported another set of solid results. So it's really been stock selection.
Okay. Do you expect to continue to outperform in the next year? Out of interest, what kind of conditions might Mobis Investment Trust underperform broad emerging and frontier markets?
We would underperform relatively if there is this single directional trade into the mega caps. There's going to be a global second wave of a flood of money into Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, Samsung, SK Hynix, and the rest of it. Then the flows would lead to relative outperformance of the mega cap market. But this would be a short-lived phenomenon. We think that there's this, the catch-up play that we are investing into is a 5, 7, 10-year story. Don't forget that, you know, LG, Samsung, Naspers, they used to be small companies only 10, 15 years ago. So we're trying to identify the next group of companies, which is going to double, triple, quadruple in size. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what will happen in the next 6 months. I think over the long term, this kind of strategy should generate significant outperformance just because these companies have the ability to multiply in size. For a Samsung to double takes a little bit more, or for a Tencent to double. I think the large companies will increasingly have difficulties, especially also with regards to regulation. And yeah, I mean, see what happened with Alibaba recently. Now there's talk that Tencent will get a fine, etc. This is just the beginning of that story.
Okay. And just finally, what changes have you recently made to the portfolio and what are the reasons for this?
Not too many. We invested in a new company called Elite Material, which is a global leader in so-called copper-clad laminates, which is used for printed circuit boards. And we think that that's an incredible long-term opportunity as the semiconductor spread is like the gold of tomorrow. They are a leader, profitability leader, they are technology leader. And these printed circuit boards need more and more sophisticated and high-quality copper-clad laminates, and they are a leading provider of that. So we were quite excited about this opportunity. We also invested in Sinbin, which is a leader in electric parts for the wind energy industry in Asia. They have a 60% market share in Asia, and we think that the US and Europe will increasingly move into alternative energy, and they are one of the prime suppliers of solutions for especially windmills. But they also have a flourishing e-bike business, we also like. So those are the ones we recently added.
Have you sold anything recently?
Yes, we sold one company in Korea, which is called Hugel. They are in the pharmaceutical business. There was increasing concern about the sector in general because they are exporting to China, and the Chinese are making it more and more difficult for Korean businesses to import into China because the Chinese want to produce everything themselves. And one of their competitors actually went into serious trouble because they were accused of illegally exporting to China. And we felt more and more uncomfortable about the space and decided to take profits and sell.
Okay, now, that's all my questions. Are there any points that I've missed off that you'd like to add?
No, I think we covered everything. I hope I was able to bring this portfolio to life and the story to life. I think in summary, one more time, it's a highly differentiated story. I'm hugely optimistic about the opportunities because we're not, you know, when the stocks, we're not competing with the BlackRock's, Fidelity's, etc. of this world. We are more competing with local buyers, which is quite interesting. And it's true active investing. Working with these companies is fun and very it brings us a lot of fulfillment.
Okay.
Thank you, Carlos. A really interesting insight into how it's possible to apply an ESG investment approach to emerging markets, and helpful update on Mobius Investment Trust.